You know what I can do now?
You can put in sound effects, maybe, or music.
Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. I'm Carola Boom.
And I'm Richard McCarthy. Yeah, this is great. This is all live now. It's not Carola mixing in music. She's doing it live rather than later on.
But I mean, I have to do this now.
Yep. Okay. Okay.
Right. So last time we were, of course, talking about our wishes for the European Union.
Our wishes for them, yes.
And this time around, we looked at Ursula von der Leyen's vision for the next 5 years of the European Union. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do a bit of a
comparison with what we were hoping for last time.
She's good enough to read our thoughts.
Maybe she is. Hopefully, she does map what we said.
So the document that we're looking at was written by her as part of her campaign process and then published after she got elected. A Union That Strives for More, My Agenda for Europe, by candidate for President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. Political Guidelines for the Next European Commission 2019 and to 2024. So it gives us good insight of what her vision of the top priorities for the European Commission are.
Yeah.
That this happened around this time is quite crucial because, of course, we're dithering away from Europe as we speak with Boris Johnson having become Prime Minister. And it's actually quite good to see sort of a positive vibe of Europe moving on very progressively, very courageously. Now, we have different opinions of Ursula von der Leyen. So I'm more positive than Richard.
Yep.
And that might make for an interesting discussion.
Okay, right.
Our wish list included climate, of course.
Well, addressing climate crisis.
Then it was about addressing and shifting the common agricultural policy to address
to help address the climate crisis.
Then there was my personal wish of helping us out of Brexit.
Yeah, I think the fairy hasn't appeared to be able to just wave their wand about that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm still looking for those fairies. We discussed maybe the Queen is the fairy.
And even Ursula von der Leyen is not that person.
And even Ursula von der Leyen might not be that person, who knows. Another wish of ours was in the area of human rights, that maybe the European Union could follow the rule of law much more or enforce it more in relation to human rights.
Yeah, both within and without the European Union.
Our fifth wish was about resolving or finding solutions in relation to the immigration crisis.
Yeah, that's what we were thinking about the human rights.
And it's very much ingrained with that. And then the sixth wish was just, and you slipped that in, you know, we didn't talk very much about it, but fairer tax.
Well, it's to pay for the looking after immigration and making sure that we can address human rights properly.
So our six wishes: climate, agricultural policy, Brexit, human rights, immigration, and fairer tax. And her six areas are a new European Green Deal. So we've got the same top priority there. Her second area was about the social market economy.
For people. Economy for people, I think she calls it.
Yes, but she mentions in that document also the social market economy, which is really quite nice to hear from a conservative, actually, because she's centre-right. Her third area is sort of the digital economy, digital Europe. She heads this up as Europe fit for the digital age. Her fourth area is protecting our European way of life. So this is all to do with the rule of law, immigration, the security aspects. Her fifth point is a stronger Europe in the world, which is all about the international relationships that we have. And her last one is a new push for European democracy. So she fairly maps onto our areas. I think the one area that we didn't mention at all was about the digital economy and digital Europe.
Yeah. I think we didn't. I mean, we'd been talking about that, about fair voting and stuff like that. But yes, you're right. We didn't address that.
Yeah.
In our wish list.
The area that she didn't attend as much as we would have liked was the common agricultural policy, because it's so tightly ingrained with the climate crisis.
Yeah.
And so today we're just going to deal with the Green Deal, because for us, of course, that's the most important. I would suggest that's for the world the most important. And then we'll follow that up in the subsequent podcasts with the other sections.
Yeah. Of what she said, the European Green Deal is the most important. It needs to go a lot further as far as we're concerned. Well, I think as far as I'm concerned, surely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we discussed before, I think there's a difference in terms of what I perceive as political feasible, which clashes with what we know needs to be environmentally sustainable for the future. So there is a friction there between we have to actually be much more environmentally sustainable in order to save the climate. But that's not, I would suggest, that's politically not doable with the processes that we have. So I think her expression of the vision for the next 5 years, I quite liked it because it had an emphasis on the Green Deal. It's right there in the beginning, even from a, you know, from a center-right conservative. And it says the right things. So she commits to the right things. And of course, it's always the question of, will she produce those results? But from her expression of commitment, I think that's there. Whereas you feel...
It just doesn't go anywhere near far enough.
But, I mean, you come from a perspective of, you know, Extinction Rebellion saying we have to tackle this as a third world war in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And you felt, you know, that this is by far not
yeah.
that.
I mean, you know, the big thing is carbon emissions, carbon dioxide emissions. So she's looking at maybe getting them down by 50% or 55% by 2030, and only really sticking to a 40% definite reduction, because that was in the Paris Agreement goals. And those amounts aren't going to be enough. You know, it's been shown now, we know that if we stick to the Paris Agreement goals, we will not only have 1.5 degrees warming, we will be more likely to have 2 degrees warming. And 2 degrees warming is on the verge of runaway global warming, which would mean that all the ice caps, you know, every bit of ice on the world will melt. And that means that inland in continents, there will be no water, or certainly not the water in the rivers that there is at the moment, because those are fed by glaciers. And water levels would be higher, which means that most of the world's cities will be underwater,
right?
Because most of those are, a huge number of the world's cities are at sea level and on the coast.
Yeah,
because those are the most productive areas.
And I do get that. But of course, you know, in some ways, I think this is the biggest expression of a Green Deal that I've seen in recent history from mainstream political parties. So even in this document, she suggests becoming the world's first climate neutral continent is the greatest challenge and opportunity of our times. It involves taking decisive action now. We will need to invest in innovation and research and redesign our economy and update our industrial policy. So she says all the right things. We have to change how we produce. We have to change how we live. She also mentions we are on track to meet our ambitious Paris Agreement goals and 2030 targets, but we need to go further and faster if we're serious about climate neutrality by 2050.
Yeah, but those things were said 20 years ago. So politicians said exactly the same stuff, same sort of stuff that she's saying 30 years ago. They said the same sort of stuff 20 years ago, and they said the same sort of stuff 10 years ago.
Right, but it wasn't in a declaration. It's now foregrounded.
Okay, well, we all signed up to the Paris Agreement, which apparently Europe is meeting, but I think Europe's only meeting it because we don't include emissions from aeroplanes which fly out of Europe. We don't include shipping emissions. Apparently, we're not including traffic emissions either.
Okay, so, and that's where she says, I will propose to extend the emission trading system to cover the maritime sector and reduce the free allowances allocated to airlines. I will also propose to extend this further to cover traffic and construction. So she's extending those.
Yeah, hopefully. But in order to extend those, we're going to have a huge, huge fight. And we've got to be ready to stand up to the United States and to China in particular. So
how does that emissions trading system work?
The emissions trading system, the emissions trading system is whereby we say, Europe says there's going to be this amount of carbon dioxide allowed for this year. And all companies, all big producers of carbon dioxide have to buy carbon dioxide credits. And then by the end of the year, they have to show, they have to pay those credits in order to have emitted that amount of carbon dioxide. And if they don't have the credits to pay for that amount, for the amount of carbon dioxide they've emitted, then they get fined big, huge fines. But there are a lot of things went wrong with the emissions trading system. In actual fact, it trebled in price over 6 months, so it went up very steeply. And we might all remember things like petrol becoming more expensive suddenly and things like that happening around that time. Then what happened was, unfortunately, they gave out huge amounts of free provision of free CO2 emissions to high fossil fuel users because they didn't want to make they didn't want to turn industry on its head just like that.
Right.
But at the same time, the world economy took a huge downturn. And that meant that those fossil fuel users suddenly had loads of these things lying around, which were worth, I think, 30 euros per ton of CO2 emissions. So they then sold them to other people. Hmm. So they made a load of money out of not actually producing what they said that they were going to be producing, but just selling euro emissions, which they were given for free by the EU. So there was a sort of big windfall for people who used a lot of fossil fuels. Unfortunately, over the space of 1 week, I think, the value of the emissions trading halved. So it went from 30 euros per ton of CO2 down to 15 euros per ton. And then over the next year, it went down to zero.
Yeah.
So it wasn't costing anybody anything to get the required amount of. It didn't really stop anybody from producing CO2 emissions.
Shall I play my stirring sound?
Okay, yeah. Go on. about that. It's
quite a long explanation. So in really, really short terms, the emission trading system, let's say I'm a big producer, I'm a factory which produces pots.
Yeah.
And I'm the biggest one in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
With whom am I trading my carbon emissions?
Anybody. Anybody else who has carbon.
Where's the market for me to go to?
All over Europe. And actually, it goes outside of Europe as well.
But, you know, how do I do that? Do I go to another company and say, you know?
Yeah, you go to them and you just say, look, we would like to buy some of your carbon emissions off you.
So is there a carbon currency market out there then? How does that work?
As far as I understand, you just pay them money and then they send you their carbon emissions. You know, they've got certain number of carbon emission credits. They send you some of those.
Right.
Maybe, presumably it's linked back to somewhere in the EU to say, 1,500 carbon emissions have been traded from this company to this company. So adjust those systems properly in your database, please. There are emissions trading systems in different ones around the world, and the European emissions trading system is the biggest one.
Right. Okay.
But really seems like it didn't work. It wasn't managed very well, I think, because of fluctuations. When we stopped producing in 2009, because the economy crashed, so what stopped us producing CO2 emissions was not the emissions trading system, it was because nobody had any money.
Right.
So nobody wanted to buy anything, so the companies who were making things stopped making them, etc., etc. So that meant that all our emissions went down quite a lot. But that meant that all the emissions, the emission credits, became almost worthless. But those could also go on to the next stage. They were allowed to be used later on.
And
so people sold them for next to nothing. And then when the economy began to pick up, people had loads and loads of emission credits.
Okay.
So the emissions credits themselves were not at all a driving force for reducing CO2 emissions, which is what they were supposed to
be. So there's an issue with the emissions trading system.
Because the plan is that you let out a certain amount now, and then you say next year there's only going to be 95% of that, and then 90%. So people go, it's going to be more and more expensive each year, so I've got to become more and more efficient. So it's supposed to drive efficiency.
Right. Okay. So are we saying that that doesn't work?
Yes, it didn't work.
And
it cost a lot of money.
Okay, so we are trying to find systems where we don't crash the economy, but manage to shift the economy to more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to create a metamorphosis where we create a more sustainable economy, green economy for the future. And of course, it's the question of how do you do that without crashing the system?
Mm. Well, I think they've said that what they will do now is that they will make all the emissions that they trade, instead of giving out allocations of emissions, which is what they did then, there's been several tranches of emissions. So there's one between 2005 to 2008, there was one 2009 to 2012, and now we're in the almost the end of 2013 to 2020. Right. And then there's going to be one to 2021 to 2030. And that's supposed to deal with the 40% by, I think they said that they'd cut down the actual emissions credits given out by 2.5% each year to get us down.
And I guess there must be hope. You know, I don't want to say there's hope, but there must be hope that we can achieve these things. And I just remember, you know, growing up in Germany, I've almost always lived near the Rhine River. Now, the Rhine River, of course, is a heavily industrial populated area of space alongside the Rhine River. And certainly in the 70s and 80s, everyone knew it was so polluted that you could hold an undeveloped photographic paper into the Rhine River for 30 minutes and it would develop that. You know,
did everyone you ever knew try that?
No, I didn't. But there were loads of, you know, of experiments like that. And of course, then there was a big drive to clean that up. Mm-hmm. And it took 10, 15 years. In the mid-90s, I don't know who it was, but there was a famous politician who donned a wetsuit and who went swimming in the Rhine. And it was a big sort of, you know, celebratory act of saying, you know, we're confident about the cleanliness.
I'm still
of the
okay.
Rhine
and he
again.
Didn't tell anybody that why he was off work for
now.
The next 2 weeks.
But, you know, the result is that and fish came back and then there was a time where there were no fish. And I also remember, you know, as a child, I went always to the North Sea for my vacation and the North Sea had crabs everywhere, you know, just, and squiggly jelly
little
fish
worm things
and what do you call the circular horses, the little horses?
Seahorses.
Seahorses, And, you know, my childhood was filled with these things, these animals in the sea kingdom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fast forward 15 years, and as a teenager, I went back to the North Sea. And compared to my childhood, it was dead. You know, this was then, you know, back of the 80s. And then slowly it came back again. And then I went back when I was in my 30s, and it was slowly coming back again. So, you know, we must hope that we can shift that and U-turn our production methods from consumption and
throw away and waste
to something which is much more sustainable. Having said that, just going back to what she said, the emissions trading systems, and it seemed to not include the maritime sector, and it seemed to not include all of the airlines, and it seemed to not include the traffic and construction industry. Up to now, that's a commitment that she said that will be extended over that. I hadn't even realized that there were sections of the emission trading system, like flights, that it doesn't attend to.
I don't know about the others. I can tell you why flights aren't included.
Why?
So they were supposed to be included in 2012, but America passed a law making sure that all of its national airline providers were not allowed to pay taxes to Europe in terms of emissions trading taxes. American airlines weren't allowed to pay those in flying into Europe. This was 2011, the end of 2011.
Wow. Oh, gosh.
They just said, you can't interfere with our flights, our planes.
So we just took it.
Yeah. Well, there was that. And also China said, if you do that, we're not going to spend the 60 billion euros on the big European plane that was being produced at the time, you know, the huge one.
Right.
If you impose that tax on our aircraft coming into Europe, then we're not going to buy that 60 billion euros. So we caved.
And I think that's probably for the next 5 years, we will have to just, you know, stand up to the bullies, so to speak, to say no.
So we've got to say, if you fly into Europe, we're going to ground that aeroplane until you pay us the money for the tax.
For the carbon tax, yeah.
Yeah, and if you don't pay, well, we'll just have this big place where we lock up all those aeroplanes.
Yeah, because that's the difficulty, you know, and I understand the emission trading system to be something where we can shift our behavior within the European Union. And then I understood the carbon border tax, to which she says she wants to introduce, to be something much more, a bigger commitment than we've had before in addressing the behavior outside of our borders. And I'm just wondering if that would have helped in that situation, because we didn't have a carbon border tax at the time. And as you said, you know, maybe that was legally also too problematic and we caved and we didn't stand up to that.
You know, what we've done is we've shoved our carbon production activities to other countries like China. So instead of us producing things that we want, like lots of little plastic toys and stuff like that, China produces those things and has those CO2 emissions, etc. And then we import them from China and we say, oh, no, we're not producing CO2 emissions, but we are in terms of what we want. So I think the UK produces its own about 500 million tons of CO2 a year, but we also produce 400 million tons in terms of what we bring in from outside of Europe.
Right.
So we were talking about the emissions trading system, mm-hmm. and how it hasn't worked brilliantly. And we also talked about how...
But also how it might be the best thing that we have at the moment. We need to tweak it.
Yes. It needs... I think it needs somebody watching over it all the time and adjusting it constantly, to be honest.
And as you said, you know, you had this example of China saying we don't want to pay the fuel tax. If you make us, then we will not buy your airplane.
What's it called again? The European...
Bus? China threatens Airbus over EU carbon cap. China has threatened retaliation against French plane maker Airbus if the European Union goes ahead with plans to include international aviation in its carbon market, three sources said on Friday. And this was...
2011.
But this is where we have to stay strong in the future.
Yeah, and we have to say, well, shucks.
You know, the crash in 2008 has demonstrated to all of us that we need to be more ethically minded in all of our economic relationships. And I think that has gone out the window. And that's why we're in this democratic mess that we are, because we somehow think we can be quintessential pragmatic about it. If it makes money, then it's fine. You know, if it boosts production, then it should be fine. Well, it's not fine if it hurts our sustainability on this planet.
Yeah. I think the right has come back saying, look, everything was all right before when we did things the way we used to do it. Let's do it that way again. But we've got to remember that was we did things that way by beating countries into submission and sucking all their resources away from them.
Going back to this 2011 time, I guess at that time, although we knew what air flight was doing in relation to carbon emissions, it felt not as urgent as it does now. Going back to Ursula von der Leyen, seeing that she says we will extend the emission trading system to cover maritime and airlines and traffic and construction, I am interpreting that there is now a much bigger commitment.
Yeah, we've got to do that.
Yeah. Having said that, the European Union has just signed the South American trade agreement.
EU trade agreement with South America, maybe? Or I think it's not with South America, but with Mercosur. So is it with the whole of South America, or is it with certain countries? Or
Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Peru.
Is it the whole of South America, presumably?
No. It excludes some countries on the rim.
Argentina?
I don't know.
No, I don't know the countries in South America very well either. Yes, I only know them if they're on a risk board, which is four countries, which is why South America is so good to have in risk.
Going back to the red thread,
yeah.
The reason why I'm pulling up Mercosur trade agreement is that Brazil is deforesting the Amazon rainforest, which is one of the largest
carbon sequesters on the planet.
So those will make a crucial impact if they are being hacked down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this trade agreement, as far as I understand it, includes meat. There is a big potential for the Brazilian economy then to export much more meat, which means they will have to have more pasture land, which means there's an inbuilt affordance of them hacking down more rainforests.
And as we know, meat production is very carbon intensive.
Exactly. The Mercosur agreement with the European Union, that came before Ursula von der Leyen. But I think we now have to step up, coming back to the ethics and the sustainability. We would have to now say, look, can we, with this trade agreement, get together and say, can we shift that to a more sustainable agreement, which affords you to maintain the rainforest whilst having the income into your economy that you actually need. And we have to be part of the solution in Europe rather than part of the problem.
Yeah.
And if that means we don't get as cheap meat, well, you know, we save the planet.
Absolutely.
Right. So Ursula von der Leyen also talks about the introduction of a carbon border tax. What is the carbon border tax?
Carbon border tax is where we charge things, we add a tax to things which take a lot of carbon to produce as they come into the country, as they come into Europe.
Right. So it is about shifting behavior outside of our boundaries.
So like beef production, for example, a lot of carbon tax goes on that beef, and then suddenly the beef is not cheap here, so we don't buy it. And so they find, oh, well, we can't actually sell it to the European Union after all, so hopefully they stop making it or stop producing it and they go back to reforesting. That's the idea. So a lot of our stuff that we've got, we have externalized, so it gets produced somewhere else, and then we just buy it in really cheaply because somewhere like China has very cheap labor, whereas we don't have cheap labor.
So simplified, it is that the emission trading system is about our internal behavior, shifting our internal behaviors in order to reduce the emissions of our internal processes, industrial processes, whereas the carbon border tax is about shifting the behavior outside of our boundaries through setting a tax that is carbon-based at the border.
Yes. Not just that, it also prevents our industries from becoming unviable because, you know, if we say we're going to cut down our carbon emissions on so-and-so, then it may be that to make a certain product costs a lot more here than it does somewhere else where they get very cheap and easy fossil fuels. So they make it all cheaply and easily, but then by the time it gets to our border, we say, oh, hang on a minute, you used a lot of carbon to make that, so we're going to slap this tax on, and then suddenly, hopefully, it should only be the same price as what we can make it for in the EU.
And of course, I think, you know, you're probably also not aware of, I'm not aware of the details of the agreement, of this new agreement, the Mercosur agreement with the European Union, and whether it has some aspects about carbon border tax already integrated in it, which we would hope, because we do need to shift that. You know, if the Amazon rainforest is gone, then that means there's irreparable damage to the environment and we have a climate running completely amok. I think this is that expression that, you know, the Ursula von der Leyen's commitment, her expressed commitment to deal with that area is something that I certainly welcome. So I see it rather as something positive. You don't think it's enough?
I don't think it's... Well, I mean, this whole section is just not enough. I mean, that's okay, that's good. But I realise the last time they tried doing the emissions trading system didn't seem to work. So between 2005 and 2011, we spent 286 billion euros on the emission trading system. CO2 emissions went down by 8%, but it wasn't really due to the emissions trading system. It was due to things becoming more efficient and the economic crisis and stuff like that. In 2016, German companies or company directors of big companies who are signed up to the emissions trading system said they don't ever see it affecting their production of CO2.
You know, for instance, growing wood is good. It captures the carbon.
As long as you do it in the right places.
Where's the wrong place
well,
for growing
don't,
wood?
Don't grow wood on a peat bog.
Oh, of course.
For example.
Yeah,
because that will release carbon.
Yeah, but you want to keep the peat bog because that's also a carbon sink, as they say,
yeah,
a carbon
catcher. It's got
masses
of carbon stored.
That's why you don't want to use wood as fuel because you're just simply burning and releasing carbon into the atmosphere, but you want to retain the wood. So there's always this notion of can we create a wood-based economy where most of our products that are at the moment done out of plastics are done out of wood so that we have to create much more forests. And then that captures the carbon, doesn't release it, we don't burn it, so our brush is out of wood, you know, more products out of wood. So I'm just wondering, you know, that wouldn't that be the solution, the simple solution that we say we don't want to have meat, we want to have wood products, but it has to come from sustainable forests. A wood-based economy, a wood-based circular economy. And Humpty Dumpty, the world is all right again.
Yeah. How far is it from here to Brazil, South America?
Right, okay. So
7,000 miles. So we're transporting all of those things over 7,000 miles, whereas we should be growing them ourselves. You know, Britain, we have 13% of Britain is woodland. And I think the average woodland for Europe is 47%. So we're way behind the average amount of woodland. So we should be planting
much more,
vastly, huge amounts of woodland, which by 2030 would be taking on board quite a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. And yes, you can use wood a little bit for energy production, but it's the scraps of wood, you know, the offcuts. We would want to grow wood that we can turn into, have as planks,
furniture
and build houses out of, and that sort of thing. You know, and then it gets built into a house and it stays in that house for the next 100 years, hopefully.
And of course, you know, that points to the other thing that, and we've discussed that before, can we create a sustainable economy whilst maintaining a global economy? And there's, of course, a friction between these two things. We have to have much smaller transport distances in order to make this work.
Yeah, I think in terms of a global economy, we should stop having global economies.
We got to buy local.
Yeah, we don't need to be buying wood products from South America. But there's tons of wood in Europe. So we want to energize our own. You know, in terms of a trade deal with South America, maybe they've got something there that we desperately need and we can't find in Europe. They have the Amazon rainforest. The big thing is there are species and there's all sorts of stuff in the Amazon rainforest. It is thought that, you know, maybe we can cure loads of different things. So there's lots of research inside the rainforest and with products of the rainforest that maybe could be carried out. That's the sort of trade that we would need with South America.
I guess what you're also saying is that we do need a sort of globally conscious economy. It's not a global economy where we just trade with whom it's cheaper without considering the cost. And if that means we have to pay those countries to be able to afford to maintain them for their communities, to make that sustainable, that's also our responsibility.
Yeah, because we're the ones who buggered up the planet.
Yeah.
Really. I saw a fantastic thing the other day, and it was about carbon dioxide emissions for different countries. And it started off at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So Britain was way out in front of everybody else in terms of carbon emissions. And then other European nations caught up. I think right at the beginning, China was at the front, simply because there's a bigger population in China. But their carbon production per person is far, far less than ours. So we overtook them as soon as the Industrial Revolution began, and then other people came up and so on and so on. And America only overtook us, I think it was like the 2030s or 40s or something, in terms of total carbon production since, you know, year dot type of thing. And we are still fifth. We're fifth nation of the world in terms of carbon dioxide production since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So we in Britain have a huge part to play in the amount of carbon that's gone into the atmosphere. So, yes, we've got to take that on board. But we've also got to, you know, we need to sort our own house out initially, but we need to be aware of, as we develop technologies that don't rely on fossil fuels, we've got to spread those out to South America and to Africa and hopefully to Australia in particular. You know, America, China, Russia ought to be able to kind of look after themselves so that we can buy and trade with them, perhaps, these technologies. But we're going to have to start saying, no, bog off, America. We don't want your products. We don't want anything from you if it's been produced with massive amounts of fossil fuels. We just don't want it. Go away. We're not going to trade with you. Boom. And the same sort of thing with China.
But of course, that's not going to happen if we Brexit. You know, coming back,
it's not going to happen with Britain, because we'd be desperate to trade with them if... Because we're not going to trade with anyone otherwise.
And of course, you know, that points towards something which is quite depressing, that, you know, countries like the UK, France and Germany, we've always seen our history, especially the history of the Industrial Revolution, as an element of progression. But we have to turn it around and say, we were also the biggest culprits and we have a responsibility to address that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how does the circular economy fit into that? So she mentions also circular economy, and I thought, again, you know, it's brilliant. You know, I know that you always say she could do more. I always say, in terms of the political process that she went under, that's the best that she could do in order to get voted in order to make these things happen. And it's the right sort of commitments in the right sort of area. So circular economy, she says, we will be a world leader in circular economy and clean technologies. We will work to decarbonize energy-intensive industries. So circular economy, in a nutshell?
Well, I think that's been largely focused on plastic production and plastic waste.
But that's plastic on the one hand. Circular economy goes much further.
Well,
further
the circular economy would bring the plastic back in and keep the plastic going around and around and around, is the idea. And the most work seems to have been done on plastic because it's such a big, it's a huge industry in Europe. But as far as I understand, there are 27 other, not
sectors,
industries, but...
Products, materials.
Materials or products. So I think there will be chemicals probably included in that, perhaps.
Textiles. And I think this notion of that at every stage of a production process, can we design the process such that that waste product at that stage can be reused in a different manner to produce something else, so that you have little circles going around the whole production life cycle, which is circular. Right, so the circular economy has to be something which has to be embedded in the whole production process. So that's a shift in the industrial strategy, and it needs to be incentivized in some form or manner, whether that's through policy, legislation, or investment. So she suggests two, I guess, tools for that, the cohesion fund, and then she talks about the just transition fund, because she suggests we need more than just a cohesion fund. We need to support people in regions most affected through this shift towards the circular economy. And this just transition fund would then support peoples and regions in those affected areas.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea. So that it's not just bits of Europe that do well from something, it's the whole of Europe can benefit from it.
And I feel, you know, she never mentions the common agriculture policy, but some of these things affect the common agriculture policy. The tools that she's also using, you know, as I said before, you know, also sort of incentive measures like research. She talks about research and innovation, and that's quite easy to do. You know, one can put the whole research framework of the European Union towards sustainability, a sustainable growth, or growth in sustainable measures. And then she also mentions the European Investment Bank, that part of that will be what she calls a European Climate Bank.
Yeah.
Which seems to have been an idea from Macron. We're not quite sure how it should work. So we have questions around that commitment.
Yeah.
And that quote, the Sustainable Europe Investment Plan will support 1 trillion euros of investment over the next decade in every corner of the EU.
But that seems
not
that's
enough.
So little.
And that comes right before the heading more ambitious targets for 2030. Mm. So you feel that's...
Yeah, I mean, what's the rest of the investment going to go to?
So we will have a look out for the budget and what the priorities are for the budget.
Yeah.
If you integrate sustainability, environmental sustainability and everything, it gets hidden in other parts as well. So you're spending the you know, money on policies that will achieve a sustainable...
Maybe.
Possibly, you know, but what is politically doable... You feel that taking the quote by Extinction Rebellion, you know, this notion is that we have to tackle the climate crisis like a third world war, because otherwise we are not going to survive.
Mm.
And I can understand it, but I can't reconcile these two issues, because one is about getting somebody into a place where they can effect a change. That's the sort of political democratic process. That radical Extinction Rebellion speech, you know, she couldn't write that kind of speech because she wouldn't have been voted in to effect change.
Mm-hmm, maybe. And that is the point of Extinction Rebellion, as far as I understand it. It's to make a political environment where you can change things properly for the environment. Their big thing is to tell the truth about what's happening in terms of the environment. So in that respect, the BBC in Britain didn't give all of the information about what the ICCC came out with. They didn't say it was a possible extinction possibility.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't talk about that. So nobody in Britain got to hear about that at all. So Extinction Rebellion said, we want to A, tell the truth, and B, they've got to get out there and, like the early Christians, if you like, they have to go out and tell everybody about it.
Yeah. And of course, we desperately need it, because the more we are being pulled to the right, the more we are getting an environment where nobody cares about the environment, it seems. You know, it's
yeah, we're just being told business as usual. It was the way it worked. Let's go back to doing that.
Yeah. The last section of this chapter then about the Green Deal, I found less convincing. So in overall, you know, as you can tell, I'm pretty much convinced, and I look forward to seeing what comes out of the European Union in relation to the environmental climate related policies. But, you know, this last section talking about the introduction of a biodiversity strategy for 2030, the farm to fork strategy on sustainable food along the whole value chain, you know, which of course goes towards the agriculture policy, but there's just no umph behind that. She also talks about Europe leading on the issue of single-use plastics, but there are no tools being put forward to achieve that. She doesn't mention the agricultural policy at all, and I think maybe that is political as well. The farm-to-fork strategy has been a strategy since, gosh, you know, more than a decade in the European Union, about understanding the food chains, the value chains around sustainable food. So, it, you know, that feels a bit, you know, the
wishy-washy.
But overall, in terms of the European Green Deal, I welcome this expression where she aims to frame this common work that needs to be done in Europe, foregrounding the Green Deal as the first priority. And yes, the devil is in the detail.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what you're saying. You haven't seen that ambitious. You're missing the ambition in relation to that, needed in relation to our reality.
I think the people who've looked at the detail say that we need a much, much more ambitious target in terms of getting rid of carbon dioxide emissions, because carbon stays in the atmosphere for a long, long, long time. And once we've put it in the atmosphere, and over the next 10 years, we can't get it out again, or it's very difficult to get it. You know, people talk about ways of getting carbon out of the atmosphere. The two most effective ways are afforestation, which is a good natural way. That's good. But it doesn't take carbon out very quickly, doesn't take it out just like that. You know, if we multiply our forests by 1.5 in Britain, then we can take out maybe 50 tons of carbon dioxide per year by 2030.
Right.
And at the moment, we produce 485 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. And we're also responsible for 400 million tons of carbon dioxide being produced in China and somewhere else, the stuff that we import. So that's an idea of how difficult it is to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The other way of getting it out is by burning something like wood, which is carbon, and getting the energy from the carbon, but then catching the carbon dioxide as it comes out, which makes the process less efficient. But if you can capture the carbon dioxide, that's not so bad. And then you store the carbon dioxide, you get it to react with some kind of rock or something, and then you bury that rock underground again. And then hopefully it stays there.
This is for energy creation, you know,
you boil water with the excess, with the heat that you provide, and you generate electricity, it's stuff like that. So you get energy from the wood that you're burning, but rather than allowing the carbon dioxide from that to go out into the world, you capture it and put it underground. Mm. But that doesn't take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
That only stops extra carbon going into the atmosphere.
So what does that all mean for, you know, individual households? If I think, you know, let's say the nice vision of us staying in the European Union, mm-hmm. let's imagine that. So we've just saved Britain from an economic calamity and we managed to stay in Britain. However, the climate is getting worse and we got to save the world. And Europe within it, and UK within Europe. So what does that mean for individual households? So you know, the circular economy as well as the carbon emissions.
I think for individual households, the big thing that we have to do is insulate them using good products like wool or wood.
So let's take our house. What does it mean for us?
When we moved in, we insulated some walls, but we'd need to insulate maybe all the walls. Maybe means heating, you know, we have a gas heating system at the moment, so the gas heating system would need to go and we'd use an electric heating system. And at the moment, we have all our electricity comes in from renewable sources. So I hope by 2030, hopefully, we'd get almost all of our electricity production by renewables. You know, it's a really tough thing to do, and we'd have to spend a lot more than, you know, it would take more than £1 trillion £6 to change it around.
So the wood burner that I would have always loved to have.
We can't really have.
We can't really have. We don't have one anyway, but...
And we've got a lot of stored wood. I've spent a lot of time producing loads of wood for us to burn, but we can't really use it.
Because we have a lot of...
That could go to the local, I don't know, some kind of carbon producing, electricity production plant.
Could we whittle bowls?
Yeah, sure, if you really want to. You can whittle away. We've got tons of wood to whittle on.
That would be the solution then. We're creating a...
Yeah, don't watch Netflix anymore, kiddies. Here's a really sharp knife. Have a go at whittling this bit of wood.
Right, okay.
It'll give you hours of fun and amusement. So anyway, yes, lots of insulation. Look at not heating to the same levels that we presently heat. You know, wear more clothing. Don't heat the house to 21 degrees. Heat it to 19 degrees maybe, because that will reduce your demand. We've got to, the same time as... Solar panels, that would be great. So if you can produce energy, produce it in a clean form.
We can hook up our rowing machine to a generator.
It won't really do anything, I'm afraid. You know, while you're rowing on it, you might light a very dim light bulb or something.
Right, okay.
But that's all you're going to do. And then as soon as you stop rowing,
light bulb goes out. Then shopping local.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, and
changing all the roads into cycle lanes.
Absolutely. Everybody cycle everywhere. That would be really, really good. Yes, we'll need cars and we'll need to have some transport. I think we need some kind of shared car ownership scheme so that we don't have a car per household, but maybe a car shared between five households or something like that. And somebody would have to work out a way of booking out the car and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think there are already some industries exploring, doing research into that in connection with autonomous vehicles, because then you could just say, could I just have a car at 9 o'clock here and then I will drive somewhere?
So taxis, basically.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. But the strange
maybe that's
thing
what
about
we should do,
it,
just switch to taxis.
Yeah, I think in Britain, because it's so car-oriented, we will first get autonomous vehicles, then public transport systems. Now, public transport systems are known to be very efficient, so I just don't get why we haven't invested in much more extensive public transport systems. Well, we know why, because it was privatized and then all subsidies were cut and nobody cares about the individuals who live outside of the, you know, London belt.
Yeah.
But
if you're a little old lady living in a village, the government doesn't care.
Yeah. So I think there will be differences. You know, so for instance, in Germany, where there's public transportation quite extensively, I would think that public transportation can take a lot of the burden and you don't need so many autonomous vehicles. I think in Britain, and we love tech, you know, there will, it's more likely that we have autonomous vehicles that we can rent than the immense investment needed for much more extensive public transport infrastructure.
Yeah. And they don't necessarily have to be autonomous. I mean, like I said, if we had taxis, it's just that we have to, people don't like that because it's seen as a high payment. I think largely we like to have our thing, you know.
House.
We like to say, oh yeah, this is my computer. Don't touch that computer. It's mine. Let me turn it on. It's always the way I want it. We like that idea about our car as well. But if you think about it, maybe it would be the case for a lot, especially if people buy brand new cars, it would be cheaper to have taxis everywhere rather than a car. As long as you weren't always using your car to get to work. So if you can change your main everyday get to work to being on public transport or on a bicycle or something like that, or a combination, then you can say, right, well, we can get rid of the car and just get taxis everywhere.
Yeah.
And the cost would be the same or less, but it would be so much less in terms of resources. You know, a town where we live has about 20,000 homes, I think. So that's going to be maybe 30,000 cars, perhaps. I don't know, 20 to 30,000 cars. If everybody got rid of their cars and we went to 1,000 taxis instead, you know, a taxi would be much cheaper, a lot easier to get.
Yeah.
And there'd be far fewer cars and less traffic.
Well, there you go then. So are you saying that in terms of reaching our environmental targets, it's better to stay out than in the EU?
Absolutely not. You know, we need all the help that we get from the EU.
So
we do need to change things, and things can be changed, but only if we have a huge will to do so.
absolutely.
And that's what the war footing is supposed to be like.
Yes. And having said that, this first section of Ursula von der Leyen's commitment or expression of commitment is better than anything that I see coming out of the UK. So I would certainly hope that we stay within the EU in order for us to push through much more environmental and green strategies.
We need the scientific knowledge, we need protection from people like America and China. We need food. And if we can't get food from the EU, then we've got to go so much further, which means our carbon footprint becomes bigger and bigger. Mm. So it's a crazy thing to do to come out of Europe.
So staying within Europe, and I think that's a good place to end
okay.
for this week.
And we're going to look at the rest of this next time?
Yeah. So if you enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, because it really does help for others to find us. Feel free to follow us on Twitter on Dithering on the Edge at DitheringE. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
And have a nice week.
Bye.